I want to encourage you to be gentle with yourself. Trauma is really, really hard. So if you're struggling, it may not be you, okay? It's just trauma. Trauma is hard. Like, I've been doing it for 18 years. It's still hard, okay? It does get easier, yes, with experience, with training, with supervision. It definitely gets easier. But on some level, there will always be, you know, a case here or there where you think, oh, what am I doing? And that's part of the deal. You will never get away from that.
So welcome to Good Enough Counsellors, the podcast for growing a private practice without the pressure to be perfect. I'm Josephine Hughes, counsellor and creator of Therapy Growth Group, helping you get the clients you want and to create the practice of your dreams. In today's episode, I'm joined by Micah Beach, an experienced trauma therapist, supervisor, and trainer. She originally trained in the Netherlands and has worked in a wide range of settings, including rape crisis, victim support, hospices, and the Children's Society, where she works with refugees, people who've been trafficked, and people who've been exploited. Micah currently works as a clinical lead for the Children's Society and is the director of the Beach Practice, where she provides predominantly long-term psychotherapy to traumatised clients. I'm not going to go through the long list of Micah's qualifications in trauma, but suffice it to say, she's probably got virtually everything. The other thing that Micah does is she also runs the Beach Trauma Academy, where she trains other therapists to work safely and confidently with trauma with a 60-hour foundation diploma. Her work is grounded in deep compassion, clinical expertise, and a real commitment to making trauma therapy more accessible and effective. Welcome, Micah. I'm delighted to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming. So, you know, obviously I really wanted to invite you on because of all your knowledge and expertise around trauma, because this is something that you've worked with for most of your career, isn't it? So yes. Could you tell me, take me back to the start, what first drew you to this field and what was it like? Because I think it's about 18 years ago when you first started working with trauma. Has it changed a lot since then? And what drew you into working with trauma?
Yes, it is. 18 years already, which feels crazy. So I originally trained in the Netherlands as a counsellor. And quite early on, there was just something about trauma that appealed. I purposely chose placements, for instance, with victim support, or counseling departments where I knew that they worked a lot with domestic abuse. There's something about trauma that despite its awfulness, it also makes sense. You know, it resonates. So yeah, I've done the training and then worked in the Netherlands for a couple of years. And then when I immigrated to England in 2012, I retrained, did all the training again, this time to get the UK registrations.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So
a double batch. And yeah, and continued working in trauma. There is, I do feel in 18 years, things have shifted a lot. If I look at some of the original philosophies almost, you know, that I was taught or ways of working, I work very differently now than when I started 18 years ago.
Yeah. How is it different now?
You know, there's all these methods that even though they existed 18 years ago, as, I don't know, maybe it was slightly different in England, but in the Netherlands, I was not very familiar with them at all. I mean, I hadn't trained in them, but also even just if you would say IFS to me 18 years ago, I had no idea what you mean.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm trained. So it's, and the same with EMDR, it was obviously already there 18 years ago. And I think it has, at least that's my thought. I think it's gathered a lot of name, a lot more research has come out in the last two decades. You know, it's more evidence-based. It gained a lot of clout.
Yeah,
maybe more of a name because it was already evidence-based. It's not new. It's not, like I said, it's not been newly developed over the last 18 years. But most therapists will have heard of EMDR now. You know, they kind of know what that is.
Yeah.
Where originally, I think, when was that? I think it was in the 80s when Francine Shapiro developed it.
Yeah. So
it started really small.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just more people know about it now. And
I think so.
I mean, for me, I think, you know, I qualified 15 years ago. And I mean, literally, we just touched a little bit on PTSD. And I look back now and I worked with women in women's aid. And I didn't really know anything about trauma. I didn't know about, you know, how people could get re-traumatized. And we worked very much from a sort of person-centered lens, which, you know, it gave people space to talk. But now I think about it and I think, oh, blimey, you know, it would have been so useful to have a lot more of these techniques that people need for when they've experienced domestic abuse, because so much of it is trauma related, isn't it?
Well, so in both my training, so again, in the Netherlands, but also in the UK, it was very much of the same philosophy, as in you just do your basic training, whatever that is, you know, linguistic or integrative therapy. And then you pick up what you pick up. And because trauma is so common, you know, you're going to come across trauma, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what I've come to realize as kind of the years went on is that trauma needs something more. I think trauma is a specialty, you know.
Yeah.
There is. It's a slightly different way of working. It requires some specific knowledge and awareness and know-how. Because if I compare the way that I work now, and of course there's a natural level of experience, you know, that grows, you get better at what you do.
Yeah.
But there's, if I compare it again to when I started, there's a lot of things that, like for instance, just creating a safe space to talk about trauma. You know, we talk about that and, you know, really building that bond with the client. That sounds lovely, but in reality, I found that a lot of clients that I work with that originally didn't necessarily get better. You know, they didn't necessarily recover. And in fact, some of them just got worse. So the more we would talk about the trauma, which was, again, kind of the philosophy, as in, if you want to get through it, you're going to have to address it. And then address it, I did. But it, it didn't help many clients at all.
Yeah.
So it took me a lot more training, clinical supervision and understanding before that real recognition came in to say, right, yeah, it's different. You need a different skill set here.
Yeah. So what was it like for you? I mean, you know, working with a lot of traumatized clients and not actually seeing that what you were doing was making a difference. What kept you going?
Yeah, it's a little soul destroying. You know, you realize it's not working and yet you're doing it by the book.
Yeah.
At least, right, the semi-incomplete tiny book with two chapters, if you like, right?
Yeah.
Very little information.
Yeah.
That is shared under the guise of that's enough. That's all you need to know. But again, realizing push comes to shove, the clients disagree.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and the clients vote with their feet. You only need some, you know, a couple no-shows, or people just don't return, or they do stick it out, but it's, you know, where you realize we've got to be able to do better.
Yeah. So what helped you? I mean, did you sort of just start looking around to see if you could find things that would make a difference? How did you move sort of much more into, I mean, obviously I didn't talk about all the things that you've got, but your EMDR, you've got IFS, sensorimotor, you know, you've got a lot of different ways of dealing with trauma, haven't you? So how did you begin to sort of move into the trauma world in terms of that sort of training?
I think I was really fortunate that some of the positions that I had came with training.
Yeah.
So even my very first placement of victim support was phenomenal, because they did in some level build a foundation. So real awareness of what is trauma, what is the impact, and what do you do?
Yeah.
But yes, then as that progressed, recognizing that for me, what was missing is a solid foundation, a philosophy, if you will.
Yeah.
Not only of what is trauma or how does it impact us, but really, yeah, what is it that helps people to get better?
Yeah.
Is it a CBT approach? Is it working with the body? Is it a mixture? You know, what is this? Almost like a holy grail. What is this holy grail? Right?
Yeah.
And where does one find it?
Yeah.
And so that kind of started me on a journey of doing more and more training. And some of them really resonated. Some of them did not.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a couple where I've done that, even though I could see on paper, I can see why this would work. And yet, you know, and yet when sometimes executing it, very limited range of success. Whereas others, when you do that, you know, clients are raving about it. So
amazing. So what would you say sort of works with you and your clients, do you think? Is there a sort of like, have you got like favorite types of way of working out of all your sort of toolkit of different trainings?
Yeah. So for me, polyvagal theory is probably my baseline.
Yeah.
That I find that theory really helpful. And also might be good to know or to just to recognize. So there are people who are opposed to the theory. There is one particular author called Grossman who said, I've debunked this theory. You know, it's not correct. It's not true. Mm-hmm. And then Porges, who is the originator of this, then disagreed with his findings. So they are battling this out.
Yeah.
But for me, you know, this theory has been validated by kind of the great ones in, you know, in the field, like Bessel van der Kolk, Peter Levine, R.L. Swartz, many others. And that for me is the baseline, is the recognition that trauma has an impact on our nervous system.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a way that you can see trauma in its impact when you are right there with the client in the room. It's not just a theoretical model. It's really hands-on, like right mm-hmm. there, you can see it. Yeah. And when you can work with that in a client in a regulated way, recognizing signs of safety and danger, that really creates profound shifts. So for me, that's kind of the platform that I use. And then within that, sometimes in this field, we call it jokingly like the holy triad, I think, which is EMDR, sensory motor psychotherapy, and then IFS. Right. So EMDR, the eight-phase trauma model to process traumas effectively. Sensory motor psychotherapy is very much a bottom-up approach, working with the body, which, as we know, trauma lives in the body. So really core. Mm-hmm. And IFS is another absolute beauty, which is all about the different parts, different protective parts that we have, you know, and how it relates to the self.
So did you find sort of like then you began to see a shift, like maybe when you brought polyvagal theory into the room, that was when you started to notice things shifting?
Yeah, polyvagal theory was profound because it almost created a language, you know, that I think, I mean, it's not the only theory, of course, that's out there. But for me, it created a language that I could use and that resonated with the client. You know, because they could feel it. I think that the core in trauma, and there's so much research that backs that up, where it sits, it's exactly the same part that's really hard to verbalize. And because we're predominantly a talking therapy profession, we're asking something that is intrinsically really, really hard to do. How do we talk about something that sits in the part of the brain that is inaccessible to verbal language?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think prior to that, what I looking back on that now, I guess what I sometimes was trying to do is put something into words that is almost bordering on impossible to put into words.
Right.
Especially if we know that when we're in a survival state, our speech area called Broca's area also becomes harder to access. So not only is it inaccessible and it's hard to talk. Right. So then when you look at polyvagal theory, it's much less about, you know, we need to put into words what's going on. It's recognizing, again, your nervous system, where that sits, how we shift through survival states, where our regulation is. I find it much more client-friendly, I guess, because the opposite almost feels to ask a client with a broken leg to start walking on it under the guise that it makes it stronger. Sure, maybe, but it also hurts an insane amount, whereas this is much more gentle.
Yeah. So, I mean, lots of your work seems to focus in terms of sort of like training therapists is about this sort of safety, isn't it? And keeping clients sort of safe. And that's almost what you're talking about with polyvagal theory, isn't it? That you're working with the client as they sort of cycle between the different parts of themselves as they begin maybe to become unregulated, that, you know, you're working with them in the room to regulate themselves. Would that be true to say?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think there's... And also that comes with nuance, right? If the job is only to say, okay, well, we've got to keep the client regulated at all times, we've really missed the mark. Yeah. One, that's not how life works. I mean, which one of us is regulated 100% of the time just because we're therapists?
Yeah.
You know, we're not. So it's not about necessarily even the regulation. It's, you know, that Dana talks about that resilience is the flexibility in our nervous system.
Yeah.
Not just the ability to be regulated. So that means that, yes, we'll go through survival, but also we are able to return right back to regulation. Yeah, it is a core component, partly because I think it works really well, but also if I look sometimes at my own therapy experiences, you know, the ones that sort of sorely missed the mark is the ones who kept plowing when I feel like I'm drowning.
Yeah.
And it's so hard in that moment to do it yourself, because there's moments where I think, even in those moments, like, I'm a trauma therapist, you know, get it together, come on, you know, go back to regular, you can do this.
It's amazing, isn't it, how we beat ourselves up in these moments where we actually just need compassion. It's like, no.
This is it.
Pull yourself together. Yeah.
That's it. I need to be better than this.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't work like that, right? Because when survival is triggered, it's so dominant. It takes over. You need that other person in the room. You need that co-regulation. You need a relatively regulated therapist, you know, who's not freaking out, who will, whatever you're doing in that moment, especially if it is a strong sensation, who might pause, put it to the side and reconnect. And when you know what to look for, it's a profound and really beneficial piece of work. So we focus a lot on that in our trauma trainings that we run through Beach Trauma Academy.
You know, one of the things that occurred to me, I was thinking about before, you know, we met, was you are so specialist in trauma, aren't you? And I was just wondering, you know, the sorts of things you're dealing with, you know, sort of say with your work with the Children's Society, where you're working with, you know, victims of exploitation and people who've been trafficked and, you know, obviously sort of sexual exploitation as well. It's just such heavy work. And I speak to quite a lot of private practice therapists who say to me, I don't think I could do trauma. Do trauma all the time. And yet it does seem that is really your caseload, isn't it? So I was sort of wondering how you keep yourself, you know, look, you care for yourself with so many, it must be so many terrible stories that you're hearing. I just wondered how you deal with that.
Absolutely. And it's such an important question. And that's been a journey, you know, when I started in victim support. And again, I was young, so 22, woefully unprepared, I think, for that. You know, it was such an exposure. I had people lifting up shirts to show me their stab wounds routinely, you know?
Yeah.
And also with that line of work, you would always get the police reports. So that meant I know exactly who gets stabbed and where, or who gets abused and where. So then, because I lived in the same town as where I did that placement, I have to walk past all those every day. I'm in the same buses, I'm in the same pubs, you know, so that created a huge, huge feeling of just feeling very unsafe.
And had
a lot of impact.
Was that sort of like vicarious trauma, do you think?
100%. Yeah, 100%. There was every thing we work on with clients, you know, so hugely hyper-vigilant. You know, if I'm in a bus and I know somebody got stabbed the day before in that bus, like I'm checking and finding a seat where I'd have the most view over who sits where or where my exits.
Yeah, it's that real survival mode. So go on. How did that progress then? You know, how did you begin to look after yourself more?
The thing is that it would, and that took me again years to learn, it doesn't have to be like that. You know, there are real things we can do to make sure that we are okay and we are well. We actually spent a whole day in our foundation diploma on that, on compassion, burnout, vicarious trauma, secondary traumatic stress. We look at all four. And there's a lot of things we can do because we are at risk. And you're totally right, is the more exposure we've got, in a way, the greater the risk, right? So for me and my team, we're exposed a lot. You know, I think 90-95% of all people that we see come to us for trauma therapy, you know?
Yeah.
And with that comes everything. However, there are a lot of things we can do to stay well. Some of them are really practical, but require a lot of training, just our own training, which is, for instance, to learn to not visualize the story. So when I started again, and 22, but also I had the visualizations, right? So like I said, people were lifting shirts to show terrible wounds.
Yeah.
So there was no escaping. It was constantly in my face.
Yeah.
But now I think there is a way to connect to the client deeply, but without internalizing it as my trauma. And I think that's a real skill, and it can be learned. And there's another dozen things we can do. There's something about the balance between what we see, you know, and then our own personal lives. And sometimes that's really practical. Like one of the things that I do that really helps me is that every day, usually now in the evenings, I go for an hour walk and by these gorgeous fields. right? It's so simple. It's not very profound. I just put a headset on. I listen to something that's really good. But if there is any kind of stress left in my body, I basically get to walk that out. And if not, I'll go to the gym, you know, to kind of work it out. So
yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of practical things that we can put in place to make sure that the trauma doesn't bog us down. It's very possible to be well.
And as you say, you've sort of got a whole day of that on your foundation diploma to really help people.
Because it's not the one thing. Do you know, like the same with clinical supervision. I have three clinical supervisors, you know, one for the Children's Society, one for my private practice, and then also one for EMDR. But that means that I have a lot more supervision than just an hour and a half a month. So it's purposefully putting all these mechanisms in place to ensure that we are well. And that will look like something different, of course, for every person. But it definitely doesn't have to be, because I know people fear that, to say, but if I do this, I'm going to get traumatized, right?
Yeah.
Like, I won't be able to. And don't get me wrong, there is a risk. Of course, there is. There's definite stories or moments where I feel, oof, you know, I can feel that in my system right here, right now. But yeah, it's definitely not that we're signing up to almost like a fate of, well, that's it then. You know, you're going to get traumatized.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, because I think it does. That is sort of like a real worry for people, isn't it? And it just can be difficult, can't it? I mean, you know, you're saying about, you know, walking out there, I can remember sort of after hearing a few stories, you know, just needing to dance and, you know, just sort of almost dance it out of my body and listen to music and just dance to somehow discharge that sort of feeling.
I think movement is always good, you know, especially if it resonates, right?
Yeah.
So, because again, it sits in the body. So we can't think our way out of this, to say, because sometimes, you know, people say just almost think happy thoughts. No, that's not where it sits, right? That's not quite where it sits. So doing something with the body, I think, is important.
Just a quick pause to let you know that if you're feeling the weight of private practice, whether it's marketing, client work, or figuring out what to do next, you don't have to do it by yourself. Inside Therapy Growth Group, I do run regular coaching calls, and we can often spend 20 or 30 minutes with one person really digging deep, helping them to move forward in their practice. It doesn't matter, it can be about your confidence, it can be about attracting clients, it could be something around your private practice admin. There's so much that we can support you with in the group. And I say we because you've obviously got me, who's been working with therapists for over 5 years in Therapy Growth Group, but also you've got a lovely, lovely group of peers as well. And they have a lot of experience, and we bring it all together to support you. It's a really warm and encouraging space with other therapists who get what it's like. If that sounds helpful, check out the show notes or go along to josephinehughes.com and you can click through to the information about Therapy Growth Group there. And now back to Micah. So do you think that there's a misconception around trauma therapy that you wish more practitioners understood? Are there any misconceptions around trauma therapy?
Yeah, quite a lot, I think.
Oh, go on.
There's a list.
Yeah, go on. Tell us what's the misconceptions.
One of the biggest ones that I think comes up most in training is that if a client talks about a trauma, that means that they're processing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a given at all. In fact, most of the time, I think it's the opposite. So when a client, especially if they're relatively new clients, it's different if they've done the work and they really have processed it and they're reiterating a story to you. And you can see that they've done the work. They're genuinely.
Yeah.
But when clients come to me for trauma therapy and they will tell me a story, most of the time they're reliving it, not processing. And that's the nature of that's just the nature of the beast. That is how trauma works. Right? Because of when we dive into a story, that is basically a pool of triggers that are all being flung one after the other, because that's the story, right? Sometimes that means that for people will mobilize instantly. They'll get, you know, you'll see the fight and flight. Others, it almost means the story has become so disconnected that feeling of people are talking about the weather, way too calm. Way too calm, almost no emotion at all, like a narrative, like, oh, I saw this documentary the other day, you wouldn't believe what happened, kind of feel. whilst you tell really, really awful stuff. Mm-hmm. But either way, that's survival, right? So it's either the shutdown in a dorsal vagus or it's mobilization in our sympathetic nervous system, mm-hmm. meaning it's not being processed. They're just reliving it. So if we don't recognize that, we could be under the guise of this is great therapy right now, because look at them, right? They're sharing a story. They're feeling maybe some feelings, and they're right here. We're doing the work. I would argue again that most of the time they're reliving it, and that mm-hmm. carries a risk of re-traumatization. Mm-hmm. So that is probably one of the biggest misconceptions that I see the most. And I get also a fair amount of referrals for people who will tell me that exact thing, saying I've tried therapy, told my story, and felt worse.
Because they were reliving it.
They're reliving it.
So what's the approach, and what would be your approach then if that sort of comes across your desk, so to speak, or into the room?
So the way that I work is based on the three-phase trauma model by Pierre mm-hmm. Jeanette and Judith Herman. Separately, they've done work on that, which is before we might process, you always establish safety first. And that can take anywhere from 10 minutes to 2 years upwards.
Right.
So, which I know is a really rough estimate. And it depends on, of course, what's going on. So establishing safety means not only building, of course, a therapeutic relationship, but also working already on some of the trauma symptoms. So it means increasing some of the regulation and whatever that looks like. So for some people, it means to even just feel that they have a body, or to become connected to their partner, or being able to take the bus to school. You know, it could be a host of things. It could be around suicidal risk, you know. And it's not very rigid, as in it definitely doesn't mean you require 100% safety before you process. That's not, it's a very fluid, flexible model. Not mm-hmm. every client wants to process. Not every client needs to. Some do. So it's just about when there is enough safety, which I know is really loose, but whenever there's enough, right? Yeah, and then if they want to work through some of those traumas by processing, to then process, and then phase three is to integrate. So that means if I have somebody coming to me that says, I'll tell you what happened, mm-hmm. right? New client, I'll tell you what happened. I was in a traffic accident, and they start to tell me the story.
Yeah.
There is almost two different kinds of storytelling. If it's pretty generic, you know, like a summary, I was in a traffic accident 3 months ago. It was really awful and I broke my leg and I have nightmares. Okay. Versus, I remember I was sitting in the car. I had my hands on the steering wheel. And do you know what I mean? There is the detailed reliving experience versus the summary. So the summaries, I will absolutely, you know, that's fine.
Yeah.
But once we start to go on the detailed, basically, which most of the time, again, is a reliving, I will pause to say, before we go into the story, let's actually see if that would help you most. So sometimes what I then do is a check to say, have you ever told anyone else this particular thing, this story? And most people, but not all, most people say, well, yeah, I told my partner or my parent. And did it help? And again, most of the time people will say, well, no, I still feel awful. And of course they do, because again, that's the nature of the beast, right? That's
true.
So then I would propose a different way of working to say, okay, so instead of repeating that cycle of reliving, how about if we build a little bit of safety first, again, however long that takes depends. And then when we go through what happened, we do that in a processing way, not in a reliving kind of way. So mm-hmm. that there's enough of you in the room right here with me connected when we go through whatever it is that happened through mm-hmm. this hypothetical traumatic. Yeah.
And that sort of processing, is that where you would bring in things like EMDR?
Yeah. Mm. You know, all three actually work really well. So but EMDR and IFS and sensory motor psychotherapy can all three be used for processing. Mm-hmm. They're just very different, you know. So sensory motor psychotherapy is a beautiful method for processing, because the theory behind that is basically that the reason trauma gets stuck is because we were unable to get to safety in a fight or flight kind of way, right? And therefore we shut down in order to survive. So what it does is, I mean, trying to not oversimplify almost the method, there's so much nuts and bolts to this, as I say. But when we have a traumatic incident, we go to the moment just before that, right? The first sign of the fight and flight before shutdown, essentially. and then put the story away and reconnect to the system to say, okay, and then we basically allow the body, but in a very slow, safe, measured kind of way to express what it needed to express, right? So that's a very somatic bottom-up approach of processing. EMDR, of course, is, yeah, you process anything that comes up. So it could be thoughts, emotions, behaviors, body sensations, memories. And then IFS, we talk about releasing exiles. So they basically have the word exile, right, for vulnerable, traumatized parts. So if, there's a lot of work prior to that. You never do this in a session one. Sorry, am I going too in-depth?
No, it's great. It's great. It's really helpful. So yes, the exiles, you were saying, that you don't do them first.
Yes. So the concept is basically we all have a core self, right, which we recognize by, they call them one of the eight C's. And when we're compassionate or caring or confident or creative, courageous, and so on. But then we all have different parts. So we have managers, firefighters, and exiles. Mm-hmm. Managers and firefighters are protectors. So managers are the ones who keep our system ticking over on a day-to-day basis, right? And kind of making sure the exiles don't come up. So yeah. The job is, if they can, make sure that they stay quiet over there in a corner, invisible, right? Yeah. Out of the eye, right?
Yeah.
If they do come up, then the firefighters comes in. They'll do whatever they need to do to put the fire out. So they're right now in the moment, and it could be firefighter examples could be, a couple of my firefighters, for instance, are humor. If I start to crack really dark jokes or dark humor, most of the time it's to shut down the exile. I'll move the topic away with something funny, you know, so that I'm back out and then I'm back okay again.
So would you say the firefighters sort of regulate you, or is it not really regulation? Is it more control?
Well, their job is to make sure that the exiles, again, almost go away, that they stay quiet, right? Because the exiles are the parts that hold that pain.
Yeah.
Right, that hold that trauma and that hold that vulnerability. So it's almost like the system, or our system has devised ways that help us to function, if you like, in everyday society. Not flawless, obviously. There's repercussions, right? If we talk about firefighters, like, it could be anything. It could be gambling, sex, shopping, smoking, binge watching Netflix, eating a lot of chocolate, or doing work. I mean, the list is endless. So there are sometimes repercussions to some of them, but their inherent job is to make sure that we're going to survive.
Yeah.
Be okay.
Yeah.
So it kind of ties in with some of the other theories that we mentioned, that if we're too quick to go to the exile, to the vulnerable parts, if we hypothetically were to say, move over managers, move over firefighters, I'm just interested in you. That's where the pain is, right?
Yeah.
Talk to me. What's going on? Is the great risk of that, not only, of course, are we bypassing people's internal systems, but they can come back almost with a vengeance, because their entire job is to make sure that that does not happen.
Yeah. So it's sort of like they flood in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that happens. Like if we go too fast, say that, okay, you do a really in-depth session, and as it's funny, as therapists sometimes, we might feel good at the end, like, wow, that was some deep connecting. You know, we've done some really deep work. And then the next session, it might almost feel clamped up, completely, like, you know, 50 steps away, where you think, wow, what happened? I barely recognize the clients. Most of the time, from an IFS perspective, that would be when we didn't quite get the permission of those protectors. Yes, we connected to an exile, and yes, that exile might have been grateful or happy or relieved, but the protectors disagreed.
Right? Yeah.
So the only way to keep that from happening is they have to do their job even stronger.
Yeah.
So it's actually the other way around. You work with the protectors first, and you don't go to the exiles until they give permission.
That's really interesting. So you're working with the firemen and all the firefighters and the protectors. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a very, in that way, it's a very honoring approach.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes I think maybe in our zeal or eager or just our care, we can bypass protectors to say, look, I just want the client to feel better. You know, that's where the pain is. So let's look at the pain. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
but there's a reason why that pain is there. So, and the only thing that keeps them afloat are our protectors. So yeah, you always work with protectors first.
Yeah. It's very respectful in a sense, isn't it? Of the client's whole being. Yeah.
Very respectful.
Yeah. I was going to say, because when you said, you know, it might take, say, 2 years to help somebody get to that point where they feel safe. I just sort of wonder what that's like for you as a therapist, because I think there's part of us, you know, like you say, we want to step in and help, don't we? We want to step in and make a difference. How do you manage that really sort of like long process where you're working with people for a long time, probably without seeing, you know, getting to the heart of the matter because you're having to work so long on safety?
You know, there's two things that come to mind. One of them is, I think, to reframe that piece of work, right? I think maybe traditionally, trauma therapy is often seen as the second phase to process, right? We often associate good trauma therapy by going to the trauma, basically.
Yeah.
But if we reframe also the phase one work as trauma therapy,
yeah,
you know, then none of that is, of course, I mean, of course we know that, but it really is not wasted. You know, that is the work. And for some clients, especially if there has been a lot of trauma or the system is drowning consistently, so that phase one might just be the core of the work and that's it.
Right.
Right. In fact, sometimes when I've done long-term work with people after, let's say 2 years, they say, oh, you know, I can breathe again. I don't think I ever want to go into the trauma, but that's okay because, you know, I can look for work or I can have a partner again. I can go to the gym or whatever it is that is going on in their lives. So also phase one is as valid, if you like, as important.
Yeah.
Right, then phase two. But there is a second element there, which is, I also think in those cases that it requires almost, if I can use that word, quite a lot of stamina on our part. Because you're right, if we have parts, right, that want people to just feel better, sleep better, have less flashbacks, recover more easily, have better relationships, more connection to their bodies, and so on and so on. And you're working with complex trauma, where a year in, you see very little results. It's easy to think I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Right? What am I doing wrong? Come on. Yeah. You know, surely they must be better by now. We're doing all this breathing or this grounding and surely there must be some improvement. And that's just not always the case. Building up safety. If a person has experienced significant levels of unsafety, let's say they were abused for 15 years, you're not gonna create safety in a month, right? It is the consistent showing up time and time and time and time again that starts to build that safety. But that requires stamina, I think, on our part to not get impatient, and of course reflect, bring it to supervision, double check, you know, but just hold on, hold on. Keep going. There isn't always a quick fix, you know? I mean, trauma is complicated anyway.
Yeah.
Especially if there's been a lot of it or a lot of unsafety. It's going to take time.
Yeah. So you've done a huge amount of training. Do you ever struggle with imposter syndrome, or did you have imposter syndrome, do you think?
That's a great question. Do you know, the field of trauma is so complicated that I'm not sure that there is ever enough training that I can do.
Yeah.
You know? To really feel like, oh, I got it. Like, I got it.
Yeah.
I think trauma comes in so many different flavors and shapes. And it is a hard feeling. You know, when you sit with someone, you know that feeling of feeling stuck, that almost that oh, no feeling. Oh, no, I don't know now. What do I do now? You know, that definitely happens. I don't know if I'd call that imposter syndrome. I mean, it took me years to get there. When I trained originally, because so much information was lacking in trauma, I definitely did feel like an imposter for years. But also, you know, I think there are within that, because when we talk imposter syndrome, we're essentially saying, I am really good, but I just don't feel like that I am, you know, or I am a like a proper counselor, but I don't feel like that. But I also think there was an honest recognition in there to say at that stage, I was undertrained, you know, there was a need for something more, you know, to get in. And like I said, every job came with training, but trauma is so complicated. There's it needed more. Yeah, and that took me years. I want to say at least 6 to 8 to build up a solid sense of I know what I'm doing when it comes to my, in a way that I know is going to work. That took time.
And this, of course, is what you're now sharing, isn't it, through the Beach Trauma Academy. So tell us a little bit about your foundation diploma.
Yeah, do you know that is the exact reason why I wrote it? So
yeah,
I sometimes joke in my trainings that I might have rebranded it as all the things that I wish that I knew when I originally trained. So I put together a 60-hour NCPS quality checked foundation diploma called Therapeutic Safety and Trauma. We run that in Southend regularly and also fully online. And it covers all the things that I wish, that I know, from the baseline, right, of polyvagal theory, but also the three-phase trauma model, anchoring, windows of tolerance, and lots of little kind of little bits in there. There's so much in there that where I think, oh, if I had known this, like there's particular things as I went on my journey. I remember once when I worked with refugees and migrants, I could not figure out for a solid 2 years, and I racked my brain on that daily. Why am I struggling so much to connect, you know, to these clients? I could not figure it out, and I brought it up to supervision endlessly. And we analyzed it, you know, is it because of age, because of gender, because of ethnicity, is it cultural, is this a Dutch English kind of thing, or is it because they're from, you know, and we went on and on. And then I went to a conference where Bessel van der Kolk spoke. He spoke an hour about attunement, and that when people have gone through trauma, specifically in childhood, that the part of the brain that creates attunement basically gets harmed. It has an impact. So that means for us then as professionals, it becomes harder to attune. You know that feeling when you're on the same page with somebody? It clicks and it flows and it feels lovely. Sometimes, therefore, that doesn't happen as much, or it is slower because of that attunement. So I've put that in my training. All the things, again, where I think, man, that took me 2 years and books reading. I couldn't find it. Not find it. And then you hear somebody talk about it, you think, that's the
that's
one.
That's it.
That's it. Attunement.
I suppose, you know, just what came up for me then was just thinking about, you know, you as a trauma therapist. How do you handle the news? You know, when you've got all this knowledge, you know, just talking about attunement then, and, you know, it takes me to the world situation where you've got terrible things happening in the world and children being affected. And, you know, how do you handle, because it's almost sort of like you must have an even more knowledge of how people are being affected, you know, when traumatic events happen and there's things going on in the news.
Yeah. Do you know, if I'm really honest, I struggle to watch the news.
Yeah.
I feel like I should watch it more, but there is that for me is one of those layers, a little bit of compassion fatigue. You know, when I spend a day working with just really difficult or raw material, and I turn on the news and again, a new thing come out where all these kids are being exploited in another city and cover-ups or war, you know, I think, oh, there is no end to trauma, you know, it worries me. Also, because there is for me then a sense of powerlessness. You know, when I work with the people that I work or I train people, that is what I can do.
Yeah.
Right. But if I look at war, or you know, any catastrophe, what can I do? So
what can I do?
Yeah, I struggle with that. But like I feel I need to watch more. But there is a real reluctance when I turn it on and I watch it again.
Yeah. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think that's the thing. I mean, you are doing what you can do, aren't you? And you're doing a lot, you know, and I think sometimes it's coming back to that, isn't it? It's about, I feel powerless in that area. So what can I do where I can make a difference?
Exactly.
And you're doing a huge amount of making a difference, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm doing my best, and I can say in heart of hearts, I'm doing my best. Is that ever, you know, when I, and that was another, almost an element, a little bit of vicarious trauma. When I was, you know, when I started, I had a mistaken belief of if we do this enough, at the end of the day, isn't the world going to be a better place? You know, if more and more people heal and the generations after them also heal, and, you know, we can start to shift things. And I remember my mentor at that time saying, who was more experienced, to say, you know, that's not going to happen, right? Like, you're trying to fight a battle that essentially you're not going to win. And I remember in that time thinking, well, it's a little bit skeptical, a little bit pessimistic.
Yeah.
You know, and let's not lose hope. But now I think, of course, we can do a world of good. I'm not suggesting the opposite. Well, let's just give up and, you know, call it a day. Absolutely not. Let's do our best. But also recognizing that for as many people like you and me and many others, my team, yes, we're trying to support everyone. But also there are a host of people out there who are actively causing harm.
Yeah.
And that's a hard recognition that unfortunately won't stop.
Yeah. But a realistic one, really.
But realistic.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you got any advice to new trauma therapists?
I feel like I've got 100 pieces of advice I'd like to give up. One of them is, I guess, I want to encourage you to be gentle with yourself. Trauma is really, really hard. So if you're struggling, it may not be you. Okay. It's just trauma. Trauma is hard. Like, I've been doing it for 18 years. It's still hard.
Okay. Yeah.
It does get easier. Yes. With experience, with training, with supervision, it definitely gets easier. But on some level, there will always be, you know, a case here or there where you think, oh, what am I doing? And that's part of the deal. You will never get away from that.
Yeah.
Right? Sorry, I very think skeptical.
We just have to remember that. I think that's the thing. Yeah. We sort of hope that somehow, you know, that difficulty will just somehow disappear eventually, but it never does it?
This is it. Because again, when I started and I looked up almost to my superiors, right? The veterans in the field, where I thought, wow. And talking at that stage with them to say, these things must be a piece of cake for you, right? It must be easy peasy. It is not. It is not. Because trauma is hard.
Mm-hmm.
So one is, be kind to yourself. Genuinely be kind. You're not failing. You also might not automatically, you know, do it wrong. Trauma is just hard.
Yeah.
Get loads of clinical supervision. Find yourself a supervisor who specializes in trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different from, it's not about other supervisors not being good, but trauma is a specialty. So you want to match that with the supervisor who's also specialized in that exact same field.
Yeah.
So get that. Yeah. Invest in training. And I know investments are hard. It costs money. It takes time. Especially the quality ones are very expensive, I think, you know, the specialty ones. However, sometimes I do think the reason they're so expensive is because they're that good.
Yeah.
You know, they know what they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can, and again, that really depends on people's times and literally budget, but try to go for the actual originators of the models.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So for instance, you can do bottom-up approaches on any website, like a 5-hour CPD pre-recorded, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that to get some understanding. But if you actually want to learn it, real hands-on feedback with an assistant or a trainer, you know, actually learn it, I'd advise to go back to the originators. So you'll pay double, but you'll also learn it twice as well. So
it's worth it.
It is worth it. If I look at the trainings, the sensory motor psychotherapy through the actual Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute, I mean, it's phenomenal training. It's you train with the best, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But you gotta save forever and a day, you know, before you get there. It's really expensive.
But worth it.
But worth it.
Yeah. Mike, we're just sort of reaching the end of the time together. So I just really want to say thank you for coming along and sharing all your wisdom. And what I'll do as well is I'll put the details of your foundation diploma into the show notes, because it's something that you offer online as well. So wherever people are, they can access your knowledge and expertise, can't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, we run them regularly. And then again, the next one is the 7th, online is 7th of December, so on a Sunday, on Sunday month. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, brilliant. So you tend to do them on a Sunday, don't you? It's a day a month.
I do. Sometimes we run them on Mondays as well. But we do go for Sunday a lot with availability. Mm-hmm. Seems to work best.
Well, thanks so much for coming along. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure the listeners will be fascinated to have heard your experience. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Do come and join my Facebook community, Good Enough Counsellors. And for more information about how I can help you develop your private practice, please visit my website, josephinehughes.com. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love it if you could share it with a fellow therapist or leave a review on your podcast app. And in closing, I'd love to remind you that every single step you make gets you closer to your dream. I really believe you can do it.